You got you had Pazenti, you had Rada. There was the Deleganas had a few small vineyards. It wasn't a big winery, but they were around for a long time as well. Ducey's been around quite a while. Janelle is making wines now and has her tasting room down on 46 West.
Richard Surrett met us at the foot of a hill in the parking lot area of Rada Winery, just off Highway 46. His reputation as a cowboy is understandable. He's a solidly built guy, wearing a Western shirt and jeans. And we climb up the hill briskly. We asked him how the wine industry started in Paso Robles, passing rows of vines to the top, where he then pointed out the directions of some of the region's first wineries. He says back then, Zinfandel was the dominant grape.
You get up here now, you're going to see vineyards everywhere. Used to be, it would be this one and that one, and that would be just about it here. Then you could go to York Mountain. Willow Creek had a couple of vineyards out there, small. East of Paso had maybe 2 or 3 5-acre blocks. Then you had the Paderewski, which is off in that direction. That was planted in 1921.
Surrett is one of the old timers in Central Coast wine. So walking through these vineyards, recounting how things have changed, is a course in Paso's history.
My earliest memory is 1941 when I picked grapes. From 41 to 42, I learned to prune, I learned to pick, I learned to hoe weeds because they didn't have herbicides. And then, of course, Rada being one of the first ones here, I got more interested in it. So I come out to see if I could learn something from the guy that's really been in it for a long, long time. I'd come out and help him wash bottles or prune or even done some cultivating. And he taught me a lot.
He stops at a vine and demonstrates how he learned about cuttings.
The old man Rada showed me how to do this because he'd done it before years, even in his old country. And what you do, he says, don't get a big one. He says the smaller ones will do better. Like you cut it here and you cut it here and it's about 16 inches long and you just bury that in the ground. You get some kind of a root system going, they go right ahead and go. You know, they don't waste much time.
When the Italian immigrants who started Zinfandel grape growing in Paso Robles put those sticks in the ground, they let that vine grow into a small bush with a small trunk in the center. And when they prune the top, that's called head pruning.
But one thing about that vine is higher quality, low production. See, this is all head pruned. And what Rada had, the old vineyard, was all head pruned. There's no wire, there's no infrastructure, just one stake, and they stand alone. My dad had almonds over there that were really, really old, and I asked him if he'd pull one block out. Well, you know, they were getting non-productive anyway. So he said, okay, fine. Well, I grew a nursery. I got the cuttings from that nursery out of these old vines that were on this hill. And I grew the nursery, and the next year I planted the vines in that block. This is Oak Flat Road, and it connects with Nassmanna Lake Drive on the north end, and in the south end, Nassmanna Lake Drive again. It's just a loop in here. There was a old school, country school there, the Oak Flat Schoolhouse, that's where my father went to school, and just below it is where he was born and raised. And this house here is where I was born and raised. Yeah, it sure changed though. It used to be a great big huge oak tree on this end of the house, and one hot day it blew apart and fell down, so we had to take it down. And this block here from the road that goes to the house, right straight up to the top of that hill, down to where you see those white caps, is where the original planting of the cuttings that I got from the Rada Vineyard went. That's pretty much where my first planting went in 1952, right there in that block.
Throughout the 1950s and 60s, Surrett raised almonds, walnuts, and cattle, but also honed his viticulture skills. In the late 60s, he ventured out, just a few miles from the family farm, to find some land. From Oak Flat, it's just a couple of miles north to where he'd establish his signature vineyard.
My father and I bought this 52 acres. We split it up, and that's where the Marycrest owns the other, what my dad used to own now. And from that line right there to that other property is what I owned. And this vineyard here I planted in 1969. And it's from the old clone. And you can tell by looking at that vine, look how massive it is. Some are more healthier than others, and you can see the older they get, the more you're going to see that. And you can see it spotted out through here. And they put off some great fruit here. Oh, yeah, very great. I have dug holes in these vineyards in this appellation and dig four holes, and you get four different types of soil within 25 feet of each other. So it varies a lot. It's really, really top quality soil for quality grapes.
Surrette wasn't the only one who recognized the potential of this land. Andre Chelyshev, the legendary California wine consultant, liked the grapes from the vineyard.
I took the grapes up there off of this block. He said, "Do you mind if we vineyard designate this?" And I thought about it for a while, and the only problem I could see is you have to maintain the quality because you don't want to go downhill from that. And I thought about it, and I said, "Sure, go ahead." So in 1976, HMR Vineyard designated that wine, and it's been on one label or another ever since, whoever I sold grapes to, because they do a tremendous amount of marketing. So why wouldn't anybody not do it? The marketing's already done. Rosenblum done a tremendous amount of marketing with it.
Within Rosenblum's Appellation series is the Paso Robles Zinfandel, comprised of fruit from five distinct properties in the four corners of Paso Robles.
Surrette's grapes were a key ingredient in Rosenblum's Zinfandel lineup, as the winery got many accolades for the varietal, and Surrette's vineyard started to become famous.
From vineyards in Paso Robles, the fastest growing Zinfandel region known for its diverse
microclimate. My 2002 was number 41 in the world. 2003 was number 30 in the world.
Wine Spectator called Rosenblum a mecca for Zin fanatics. Surrette counts himself as one of them.
I like my Zinfandel. I like my Zinfandel better than I do a lot.
And his relationship with Rosenblum was so convivial, they even teased him in a promotion.
The Richard Surrette Reserve Zinfandel comes from the Surrette property located in northern Paso Robles at the base of the Santa Lucia Mountains. All head-pruned Zinfandel, the original vines were planted with the Surrette clones and the newer plantings with the budwood from the historic St. Peter's Church vineyard. Richard is known to be one of the oldest, surliest cowboys in Paso Robles, unless you're a lady. Richard's claim to fame, other than his meticulously grown grapes that he still manages on his own, is that there isn't a woman in Paso he hasn't dated.
No, they stretched that one a long ways. They really did. Yeah, they come down here with some people from San Francisco and took movies, you know. And in fact, you can see them on YouTube. And I think the winemaker, he threw that in there. And I don't know, the old cowboy and dated every, nah, that's not true. I didn't let grass grow under my feet, but I didn't date every woman. Yeah, they just threw that in there. And I didn't get a chance to edit that with them. People get a kick out of it, you know, it's kind of a fun, and they knew it was a joke.
Richard Surrette can not only laugh at himself, he's also accessible and unassuming. When I first moved to the Central Coast about 5 years ago, I signed up for a wine tasting dinner at Thomas Hill Organics, which was offered to the general public. I sat next to this farmer who didn't use wine jargon, didn't reveal what he did for a living, maybe until about halfway through the evening. Despite nearly 70 years of experience in farming grapes, he still says he's learning.
With grapes, you and everything for that matter, you need to keep an open mind. Never, ever think you know it all, because you can learn something all the time. Mother Nature forces you into that because of what she's done. No rain, then you cope with it. And sometimes you get a rain in October, and the vines are still got all these grapes on them, especially Zinfandel and Petite Syrah, they're thin-skinned. They split, and then they start getting rotten, then you lose them. The university's done an awful lot of work the last 35 years on this, and they keep making changes. Sometimes I don't always agree with them, They get all their education from a book. Yeah, they have some test plots and so forth. I never did go to school, but I learned from the practical end of it. And sometimes I think that's better. People come in here like they have in the last 30 years and they buy property. It's been, you know, wealthy people want to get into the grape business because it became very popular. They've asked me if I could help them out. And they say, what kind of a degree you got? I say, I don't have one. I got practical experience. They couldn't use me. They said, no, we can't use you. You don't have a degree. You don't have a piece of paper that says you got education. It seems like anymore, if you don't have a piece of paper, you got nothing. That's hard to believe, but it happens. And then 2 or 3 years later, they're out of business.
In our tour, we got plenty of lessons on viticultural techniques, some just too technical for this story. But there was an overriding theme, the sustainability of old farm techniques, like planting head prune vines in a diamond pattern.
If you put them on a diamond, when you cultivate, you got a lot smoother ride. But you can cultivate three different directions on a diamond and only two on a square.
And then there's an old California farmer's pet peeve.
It's one of the largest mistakes this industry ever got into. When you put 1,200, 1,500, 2,000 vines per acre, look at the competition within them. And you just have to continually water, 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 so they'll survive. These here, if you cultivate and do your viticulture practices like you're supposed to, you can actually depend on rainfall. I never had an irrigation in any of my vineyards until 1998. Just all dry farm, totally dry farm. And I have mentioned it in my newsletters, the Independent Grape Grower newsletters, that they may one day be pulling every other row out or every second and third vine out. So it's for naught. But now they want to plant 1,500, like I say, large, high-density vineyards, and it takes a lot of water. All you do when you pump them full of water is you make a water barrier and it doesn't make good wine. See, on the west side of the river, Salinas River, you get lots of rain. Like on these hills here, you'll get twice as much as you will out there on the east side. And they have to water a lot. But even on the west side, they tend to water way too much. A lot of them do. Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen in the future, but it's not looking good. The demand for water, whether it's a human or a vine or a tree, is greater now than it's ever been. And there's never going to be enough supply for the demand it is from now on out. Because they keep making more people every day, they keep planting more stuff to grow or to feed the people. So it's going to be a tough call in the future. Well, see Peachy Canyon's house on the hill? The vineyard to the just the top of the hill? That's where we were.
At this point, we're at Richard's current house, just a few miles from Oak Flat, the Richard Surrett designated vineyard, and Paso Robles, all of which we can sort of see from this perch on the hill.
See the property below? I built that house in 1982, Vista Del Rey's house. Then I'd already bought this. If you go out in front here, excuse the mess here in front. I just put a new window in yesterday, and I'm doing some porch work. And then when that's done, get the tile back on, then I'm going to pull the deck up. Always something to do. Paso Robles is all there at nighttime. It looks like Los Angeles. And over here, even years ago, you wouldn't even see any lights over here. But now there's quite a few. It's a nice area to live. You can't blame people for wanting to be here. Yeah.
At times, our conversation crossed over into questions of retirement. Richard Surrett is in his 80s, even though he doesn't seem to be slowing down. But if he said that he wanted to keep doing this for another 20 years, you'd probably believe him. But his various comments on calling it a career are as insightful as anything else he revealed during our afternoon with him.
I sold some vineyards in 1995, 96. Long as I've been doing this, you know, you want to start cutting back a little bit. I was going to retire when I was 55. It didn't work. So I just started cutting back. When you work 16 hours a day, it's not hard to let to go some of it. I'm not growing any more wine grapes, none at all. I own 10 acres by the truck stop down there. And I grow watermelons and garden tomatoes and stuff, and I feed a lot of people. I just like to grow that stuff, so I give it all away. Gradually move myself out of the industry. Well, I'm going to continue to help people, because I get phone calls all the time about what do I do with this and when and how and so forth. So, and I like it. It's been I really enjoyed it. I've really enjoyed my career in it, though. Besides the almonds, the walnuts, the cattle, the grain, hay, and all that, I've been pretty diversified. I've been a farmer, like a jack of all trades and a master of none. Drink your wine at dinner, you go work hard in the daytime, then you work your wine off when you're working hard in the daytime, because red wine can put a little weight on you if you don't watch it. I think it's healthy, it's good for you. Yeah, good food, hard work, and good wine, not going to hurt anybody. This type of soil right here really raises a good garden, like tomatoes and watermelon and stuff. My dad used to grow a lot of it, and if I got hungry or wanted lunch, I'd go eat tomatoes, cucumbers, and corn off the cob raw and things like that.
Richard Surrett's Zinfandel grapes show up under various labels. One of them is Vines on the Marycrest, which occupies a piece of the old 1969 planting that Richard and his father put in. Marycrest sells the wines from the Surrett plantings as an estate wine from the Remo Belly Vineyard, named after the drummer who pioneered the synthetic drumhead. Victor Abascal was in the music industry in L.A. for many years before being bitten by the wine bug. He and his wife, Jennifer, started making wine in Paso about a decade ago, and we sat down to talk with him. Terrence Jones interviewed him.
I didn't have enough room on my own backyard where I was living, so I staked out some land that did not belong to me on a Catholic woman's retirement home up at the very tip-top of the neighborhood that I grew up at the top of the hill. And I cleared about a little more than a quarter acre of mustard weed on a very steep southwest-facing hill and planted about 120 grapevines on their property, foolishly thinking that they'd never find them. And then being so foolish as to cover all my vines with fluorescent blue grow tubes that literally glowed in the day, I was pretty quickly discovered. And the poor nuns, the Carmelite sisters who run the woman's home, didn't understand when they discovered them that those were grapevines. They thought it was marijuana. And they thought it was an unbelievable amount of marijuana, because if it would have been marijuana, it would have been an unbelievable amount of marijuana. So they were very frightened and very upset, and the police were summoned. And in the end, they were fabulously generous with me and very understanding and didn't throw me in jail and actually allowed me to keep them there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they allowed me to keep them there, but their insurance company found out later on, like after we had well established the ground rules and everything like that. So I did have to move them, but that's sort of the part B of the story. And that's,
yeah.
But the name of the place is called Marycrest Manor, and mine were the vines on Marycrest Manor. And that's sort of the very short of it.
Yeah.
So as a sort of homage to them for being so great and just where I started, I wasn't going to come up and do this and call my winery Abascal or something Owl or something Lane or something, you know, whatever. I just wasn't going to do that. So,
where was this?
In Culver City.
In Culver
Southern,
City. I
Southern
don't think
California.
Of Culver City as being much of a wine region.
Oh my! You know, I'm convinced that those hills up there, you know, if anybody ever really did it in earnest, would be fantastic. You know, it's 6 miles from the ocean, mild temperatures. You know, I think Syrah and maybe even Pinot Noir would do wonderfully there.
The other thing I wanted to ask is, where are we here? So you talked about this property in Paso Robles.
We moved up here in 2004, and then I began commuting about 5-6 months after I got here back to LA to support this endeavor. And I did that for about 8.5 years, and I just stopped, and so I'm You can't see the smile on my face, but I'm smiling about that.
What is so magical about this property? Did you fall in love with?
That's a good question. This property actually belonged to one of the pioneering grape-growing families in Paso Robles, which is the Surrette family. Hmm. When we got here, we bought about 600 million or so, it seemed, trees and a little Zinfandel vineyard in the back corner of the property. So it's now 55 years old, we think, or so. And it might be a little older. And we believe that it's in the top 5% of the oldest vineyards in Paso Robles. And so with that in mind, we were going to buy this. We were going to get old Zinfandel vines ready to go. And we were going to be close to a highway or a road. And we were going to be on the west side. And our dirt is amazing. We have just solid white, you know, everything is just chalky white limestone. And it's perfectly southwest oriented. It's you couldn't ask for more.
Yeah, it's a remarkable old world looking property with a lot of just exposed, like you said, white chalky gravel. It's pretty impressive. One of the themes that we see a lot here in Paso Robles, people that had past careers that suddenly find themselves in the wine world. And it's kind of an odd thing. We see in your case, kind of audio engineer moving into the wine world, or you see a dentist or some stockbroker or something having these second careers or retirement hobbies. How in the world did you end up in the wine world?
Well, you have to take one more step back and understand that while I had this audio career, I was a rock and roll musician as well. And I was very seriously attempting to do the impossible, which was, you know, make it or whatever, at least be recognized. And so it was a very large part of my life and a huge creative outlet for me. And then finally, when my head got bashed in just a little too much and a little too many times, I sort of backed away from that and almost instantly fell into making wine. And it just fulfilled everything that was being fulfilled by making music. And I just kind of dovetailed from one to the other.
You were painting a picture. I'm imagining this audio rock and roll guy down in LA. You said you fell into winemaking. That doesn't seem like something that happens naturally. You're not in wine country, you're in LA.
No. I didn't grow up drinking wine. You know, my experience with wine was the, you know, 3 or 4 year old half consumed bottle of Gallo jug wine in my parents' refrigerator as a kid, and then, you know, sneaking a sip of it and wondering, you know, why it wasn't thrown away. And, you know, my mom would dump it in the spaghetti sauce or whatever. I started sort of discovering wine, going to Trader Joe's and grabbing something off the shelf and not really knowing what it was or what it meant, but just if I liked it, then I would sort of explore what that all meant. It led me to doing a lot of traveling. I was single at the time, and I went all over the world, and every vacation seemed to be centered around wine. And as I met more people in the business, I really discovered that I liked them, and I liked what they were doing. I did want to sort of be a part of that and didn't really know how, but I started reading about it more and more, and then I started buying grapes.
And this is out of your home, kind of the
yes,
home winemaker?
Yes, absolutely. My being single and all of that, my entire house became overtaken with, in the bedrooms, my stall shower in my second bathroom, my tiled shower was my wine closet, so it was floor to ceiling with Napa Valley Cabernets, you know, way too many of them. And then my kitchen and everything, you know, people would come visit me and just think I was out of my mind, and it just seemed perfectly natural to me. So I started making just copious amounts of home wine, you know, from one year to the next, that just making way more than I should have, but really experimenting. I wasn't just satisfied to ferment some grapes and turn it into wine. I really wanted to see what would happen if I did X, Y, and Z. And so I would buy a lot of grapes, let's say 500 pounds, and then chop it up into 5 100-pound lots and then do something completely different with each lot. And then it's just a wonderful way to experiment. And you only get to make wine once a year, basically, so you better figure it out fast, you know. I often said I never met anybody I felt was smarter than me, you know. There most certainly are people who are smarter than me, but it seemed like it was absolutely something I could do even later in life.
And it was accessible.
It was. Still. It was. It just took. It just was going to take a long, hard road and a lot of patience, and you know, we're doing it.